Coming up on Tech News Today, the U.S. cracks down on the 3D printed gun, Amazon building a phone with a 3D screen, and Google scraps the physical wallet card. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 10th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT5. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show we keep you up to date with the most important stories in the tech world. Put them in some context for you, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Nokia took to its Nokia Conversations blog today to make the Lumia 928 for Verizon in the United States official. It sports a 4.5-inch OLED screen, 8.7-megapixel sensor, optical image stabilization, 3 high-amplitude audio mics, NFC, 32 gigs of storage, and, of course, LTE. The Windows Phone will go on sale May 16th for $99 on contract after a $50 rebate.
Microsoft Windows 8 users will likely get iTunes Store access. Yay! But not anytime soon. This is according to a recent interview that Tammy Reller, who's chief financial officer of Microsoft's Windows division, gave to CNN Money. She said that by the holiday season, Microsoft will support the most popular apps in Apple's App Store in its own App Store. Microsoft now has more than 60,000 apps available. Users have downloaded about 250 million of them. Just don't hold your breath for Apple's iTunes, Reller said.
According to All Things D, Google will revamp Google Wallet at Google I.O. next week. However, plans for that rumored physical credit card have been nixed. The Google Wallet service is expected to feature updated offers, loyalty points programs, and rewards with more merchants. This would make Wallet have some of the same features as Apple's Passbook.
The U.S. Office of Defense Trade Controls sent a letter to Defense Distributed requesting that the plans for the 3D-printed gun known as the Liberator be removed from public access. The State Department office believes the plans may violate International Traffic in Arms Regulation, or ITAR, rules. Wilson believes the plans qualify for public domain exemption, but complied with the request. However, the rest of the internet may not be so cooperative, as torrents of the plans have made their way into the usual places torrents go.
YouTube has announced it will offer a pilot program for a small group of partners to offer a subscription service that starts at 99 cents per month. The program will expand from there, says YouTube. The company also said it's been building out this partner program since way back in 2007, and that the over 1 million channels generating cash on YouTube, one of the most frequent requests has always been more flexibility in monetizing and distributing content, which is what the new program is about. YouTube is for the partners, says YouTube.
Facebook is rolling out a non-major update to Facebook Home today, which is in line with Facebook's new every 4-week cycle. Facebook Home has been available for, you guessed it, 4 weeks, and Facebook says the launcher has been downloaded 1 million times from the Google Play Store in that time. The launcher officially supports a very small number of devices.
The Wall Street Journal reports Amazon is not only working on a phone, you knew that rumor already, but now the sources familiar with the rumors close to the unnamed matter say the Amazon phone may have a glasses-free 3D display and maybe eye-tracking controls and a puppy, but probably not a puppy. And in fact, maybe none of it, because the Wall Street Journal warns that this may just be a push inside Amazon for a bunch of different prototypes.
The next Nexus 7 tablet may get a bunch of upgrades without having to come up from its $100.99 price tag, so says KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, who believes Google may unveil the upgraded tablet at its Google I.O. conference next week. Upgrades might include a faster Qualcomm processor, a 7-inch display with a narrow bezel, 5-megapixel camera, wireless charging, a body that's thinner, 7.5 millimeters to 8.5 millimeters thick, and lighter. Sound good?
I thought you were going to say the Nexus 7 is going to have a body that just won't quit.
Well, It'll also give you wings, Adam. The new Nexus 7 could be ready to ship in June or July. Quill also believes Google and Asus could ship 5 million units in the second half of this year.
I want a battery that just won't quit. Yeah. The U.S. Congress push to make unlocking a cell phone explicitly legal may lead to a greater fix of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The Unlocking Technology Act of 2013, sponsored by Zoe Lofgren, Thomas Massie, Anna Eshoo, and Jared Polis, not only addresses unlocking cell phones specifically, but also modifies the DMCA to make circumventing copy protection illegal only if done to facilitate the infringement of a copyright. The effect would be, for instance, you could rip your DVDs without breaking the law.
According to the Wall Street Journal, ESPN has talked to at least one major wireless carrier to exclude its content from mobile data caps. One possibility is that ESPN would pay the carrier a subsidy so users don't hit those caps. Alternatively, mobile carriers could get a cut of advertising revenue. The journal says no deals are imminent, and if a deal is reached, it could run into issues with telecom regulators.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace.com, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. Since its platform upgrade last fall, Squarespace just keeps rolling out new product features, integrations, templates. They're not stopping. They're crazy. 24/7 customer support by email or even live chat during the week. Plus, with plans starting as low as $8 a month, software and hosting, Squarespace is a real value, and it's exceptionally well-designed. You get award-winning designs that look like they were made for you, because they were, and you can customize them. So they're perfect for you. They also just added a new calendar feature called the Events Collection. Allows you to share schedule updates. You got promotions, you got events, you got meetups, maybe sales, whatever you're doing, you can put it up there. And they just released a beautiful new template called Momentum. You got to check that out. If you're saying, well, all this sounds complicated, Tom, well, it's not. Drag and drop, fast and easy to use. Their page builder tool called the Layout Engine enables you to customize pages in seconds by adding blocks of content like photos, videos, text, social media content, and immediately preview the layout as you go. Squarespace provides powerful and flexible e-commerce solution with their new store that lets you sell physical and digital goods. It's the best mobile experience because they redesign on the fly for the right screen. So whatever screen someone's looking at your site on, it looks like it was designed for that screen. Plus, they can publish to and from social media. But you don't have to take our word for it. Squarespace integrates all your website needs into one platform: domains, design, development, commerce, hosting, 24/7 customer support. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account, and you don't even have to give them a credit card or anything. Just give them an email address. Start building your website. If you decide to purchase it, use the offer code TNT5 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. Don't forget about free domain registrations for annual plan customer subscriptions. That's squarespace.com. Use the offer code TNT5, everything you need to create an exceptional website. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to discuss some of the stories in the news, very happy to have Eric Olander, VP of FBNC in Vietnam, back on our show. It's Vietnam's largest business TV news network in Saigon. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Great to be back. Hi, you guys.
It's great to have you. We got a lot of good stuff to talk about. Let's dig right in to the saga of the 3D printed gun. Now, we heard in the news fuse that they have removed the plans for Liberator from DefCAD, not before it was downloaded more than 100,000 times, though. So it is out there on the internet. Now, the DefCAD plans have been removed because the State Department, specifically the U.S. Office of Defense Trade Controls, said it is unlawful to export any defense article or technical data for which a license or written approval is required without first obtaining that required authorization from the DDTC. That's the Directorate of the Defense Trade Controls. Now, Cody Wilson of Defense Distributed, who is a law student at the University of Texas, said he believes that the plans are excluded from ITAR regulations under an exemption for nonprofit public domain releases of technical files. And in fact, ITAR's 125.1A says information which is in the public domain is not subject to the controls of the subchapter, which is the licenses for the export of technical data. There's also a lot of other exceptions to the exceptions in there. It's a pretty complex regulation. But Defense Distributed says, we also got a license to manufacture and sell from the BATF. That probably doesn't have any effect on ITAR. But what he's trying to show is we are trying to go through the forms here. And we will comply with whatever state says. But our biggest deal is that we want to have this conversation. Wilson says, Is this a workable regulatory regime? Can there be defense trade controls in the era of the internet and 3D printing? He is going through the motions on this, following the rules, because he wants to show what the regulatory process will do. Eric, what do you make of this? What's your answer to his question?
Well, I mean, first of all, Cody's an interesting guy, and he's an interesting guy to study because I don't agree with his politics, and I don't agree with his philosophy, but he's very, very sharp. When it comes to, why the State Department took this instead of ATF, it really clearly shows that this is an international issue. So you have to think about that this doesn't have anything really to do with the United States, where you can get a gun pretty much, just go down to Walmart for $20, you can go on the corner and get a gun. But, I can imagine that some very nervous folks in Paris and London and in Canada and other places where they do have very strict gun control and firearm regulations probably picked up the phone to John Kerry's office and said, listen, we don't want these plans floating around our societies. And so that's probably where the pressure came from and why the State Department took this.
And yeah, exactly. They can pretty much, this was the whole problem with PGP, right? Is that they said, well, this is encryption technology that falls under ITAR. And because you put it on the internet, people in Iran and Cuba and all these restricted places can get access to it. Ayaz, what do you make of this?
Well, I was actually looking at the statute and I was looking at Wilson's arguments, and he was claiming that if his files are available on a library computer, that it would qualify under the public domain exemption, which would get him out of all this trouble. But the first thing is, that sounds like he's saying that, yeah, he's running into violations of this, and then you have to find an exemption out of it. But the public domain thing seems pretty exhaustive. It's saying it could be at libraries open to the public or from which the public can obtain documents. Another one that seemed like it could be easily worked around, though, through unlimited distribution at a conference, meeting, seminar, trade show, or exhibition, generally accessible to the public in the United States. So in theory, as I understand it, if he shows up at a trade conference and shows this stuff off, he could get around this law as well. Although I haven't looked at all the case law to see what this looks like. This was just a cursory reading this morning.
He get around the law to show it off or to copy it and give it out.
Well, he could demonstrate these files in a public conference meeting or seminar, and that would be an exemption allowing this work to be in the public domain, which mm-hmm. should get him out of violating this law.
And essentially what the Office of Defense Trade Controls is saying is that he didn't get commodity jurisdiction approved. They're not saying he doesn't have it. He's saying that you didn't apply to this. You didn't license it. And I know some folks who work in the industry that say, you know what? If you do anything like this, you apply and you get it approved, even if you think you have an exemption. That's just the way this works. And so what's happening here could be simply, it could be all these other things we're talking about. It could also just simply be a government bureaucracy saying that item should have been put through due process or due diligence or whatever they call it. And so we have to sign off on this. They very well may turn this around and say, yes, this is not a threat. It's not a problem. You have an exemption. Go about your business. You think that's possible?
I don't think, could anybody really sit here and say, there's no threat implications here at all? This is fine.
It's not the kind of gun that's usually under control. I mean, this is a very small caliber gun in the grand scheme of things. It's not like you're going to arm the Syrian rebels with the 3D printed plans necessarily, right?
What Wilson's created.
But isn't this just the first step towards something? I mean, the implications are that eventually it'll be any kind of gun you want.
Yeah, so the thing is, if Wilson gets in enough trouble, and obviously you can't take this data off the internet. Once it's online, it's on there forever. But this could stop future people from trying to do similar models, because I believe Wilson's – one of his things that he said is, I want to be able to get a gun in everybody's hands by making this information free. So it might have a chilling effect in the future if something happens now. But then again, if it's on the internet, it's on the internet.
And I think he's also trying to demonstrate that the laws, these are analog laws. These are not laws that are really equipped for the digital era. And I think he's trying to prove that point as well, that the laws just are insufficient right now to deal with these kinds of issues. And I'm not sure if lawmakers or policymakers in the State Department get it. I mean, we saw during the WikiLeaks era where they said, take down WikiLeaks, as if it wasn't copied anywhere. And then they forbade everybody from actually reading it. So it's hard to tell if the government actually gets it. And it's also interesting to see what Cody Wilson's long-term objectives are.
Yeah, saying remove from public access, Cody's like, we'll take it off our website. But removing from public access in the age of the internet means a whole different thing. We can't just go out on the internet and remove every single copy of the file. Obviously, that's a form letter that's being used there, but it has implications. You're right, Eric. Let's talk about the Amazon 3D phone.
Yeah, Wall Street Journal's got some. They got a story out saying Amazon's working on a whole bunch of devices, and one of them is a audio-only streaming device. It uses Wi-Fi and connect to what would be a music subscription service that Amazon doesn't have right now. Wall Street Journal is also saying that Amazon's working on two phones, and as Tom mentioned before, one would have a 3D display, and it would track your eyes so that you wouldn't have to wear glasses. So you'll be able to see 3D images without glasses. This kind of technology is on certain laptops already, at least prototype ones. Previous reports said that Amazon's working on a set-top box, and the journal says that Amazon has goals of releasing some of these devices in the coming months. But then it warned some, it had a big warning. Some or all of these devices could be shelved because of performance, financial, or other concerns. So it gave this big story and saying these things could come out, and then they might never come out. Eric, do you think any of these products will ever see the light of day?
God, I hope there's not a 3D phone. Do you remember back at NAB a couple years ago and all the TVs were 3D and everybody was telling us this was the next big thing? There's just no way there's going to be a 3D phone. There isn't the demand for it. The content isn't there. I think that Amazon's gotten some fantastic PR. They've got some great people inside the WSJ who seem to like them. I just hope that Amazon does a little bit better on the hardware side than they did with the Kindle, which to me just feels a little bit flimsy, and I'd like to see a higher quality product come out of them on hardware.
Sarah, I'm thinking about 3D content in general seems a little bit silly when it comes to video and things, but Amazon sells all kinds of items. Do you think they could benefit from having a device that could show you, I don't know, a water bottle in 3D?
Well, no. Who wants to see a water bottle in 3D? That's dumb.
Anything.
But I think one thing that a smartphone has going for it is that it's always going to be relatively close to you, right? Mm-hmm. One of the problems with glasses 3D experience in a living room is that you're sitting on your couch and you kind of have to be in this one spot, because if you go too far to one side, then the 3D doesn't really work, and everyone goes, well, that's too limiting. Who wants to do that? You have to rebuild your whole living room. With a smartphone, it's kind of right in front of you. However, I don't feel like the smaller the screen, the less compelling the 3D is for me. I've said before, I think sports are really fun in 3D. That's one of the things I think 3D is great for. But I'm really not going to watch sports on my smartphone unless I have to, unless I'm in transit. For whatever reason, I can't be at home. I can't be near a larger screen. So this does not sound like something that the general populace is going to run out and buy.
Tom, we've seen 3D on portable devices on the 3DS, the Evo 3D. Not exactly like burning up the charts, not something that's going on very much. But this eye tracking ability is being developed and it's being shown on laptops and things. Do you think this has a chance?
Well, Samsung's got the eye tracking on the Galaxy S4, right? And it's not getting rave reviews. Some people like it, some people don't. I'll agree mostly with what Eric and Sarah have said, with the caveat that if Amazon could crack it, and this is why this is an internal story. Amazon, of course, all companies are working on all kinds of things all the time. Somebody just happened to leak something here. So who knows if Amazon's really going to come with this. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that they figure out the 3D screen so it doesn't strain your eyes and it looks good. I definitely would like that. And I bet people will make good use of it and find ways to make it work. All of the objections that I have are 3D screens just aren't there yet. And I don't expect them to get there that soon to see an Amazon 3D Kindle torch by the end of the year.
And then the thing is, the article does specifically mention Amazon's working on two smartphones, and this is one of them. I would assume the other one would be much more traditional. This has been rumored for a long time. I think that we're probably likely to get that set-top box in the future. An audio streaming box seems interesting in general, but I don't know why Amazon would want a device like that necessarily to be such a single-purpose device. As for the 3D phone thing, I think they probably are working on it, because why not? Like Tom said, all these companies are doing tons of prototypes all the time. Doesn't mean that this is going to see the light of day, because if it has a lousy user experience, people aren't going to buy it. Amazon wants to give you a product so you can buy products, not because it's some amazing, innovative category.
All right. Another innovative category that people are trying to crack is online payments. Google Wallet is one of the competitors there, and we just heard some news about it in advance of next week's Google I.O., Sarah.
Yeah, and it involves a physical credit card. What? Why would Google do this? Apparently, sources tell All Things D that the physical Google card, it looked like a regular credit card. It had a black face. It had a little rainbow W of the Google Wallet logo on it. Standard magnetic stripe. You know, the numbers look just like a credit card. So what happened? Apparently, in prep for I.O., which was allegedly where this card would be unveiled, CEO Larry Page watched a very glitchy run-through demo and said, you know what? No, we're not ready for this. This is not ready for prime time. And killed the card launch plan at least as of next week. The news that Google Wallet head Osama Bedier, I think that's how you say his last name, was leaving the company sort of makes it sound like, for whatever reason, there is a Google credit card. It's just not ready for prime time, and it's certainly not ready for I.O. So you might want to say, well, why physical? I mean, if Google is so interested in pushing Google Wallet, you've got your NFC technology, what's the deal? Well, Google wants to know more about consumer purchases. How do they advertise to us? They find out more about us. Sometimes credit card info is just offline level data. You know, when I'm going to Whole Foods or some sort of grocery store or small retailer, Google's not necessarily getting any of that information. It'd be great for them to have that just with a physical credit card. Ayaz, do you think that this actually makes a little bit more sense than trying to sell Google Wallet to a lot of people who don't really understand NFC or why they need that, or they don't have a compatible smartphone?
You know, when I first saw the story a long time ago that Google was going to come up with this physical credit card, I thought this was a brilliant move because you would have a greater acceptance because people understand what this is. But try to educate people about a Google Wallet app and service that you put in all your information to, and then you have to use your phone to tap to pay. That, I think, is asking a lot of the general consumer, although this could be a really good focused smaller test because the people that are using it are very enthusiastic and will try it. Because if you're willing to pay for stuff with your phone, at least in the U.S., it means that you're kind of a little bit, I would think, a little nerdy to be doing that. I don't think this is something that my mom is going to be using right now. But I think that someday maybe they will come up with that card because it seems like it makes more sense for Google to track data. That's what they want. They want to give you the best ads, and you see that, you'll click them, and Google makes more money that way.
Ron, Google introduced Cloud Wallet last year that would work with existing credit and debit cards. Eric, do you think that we're going to see a physical Google card later this year?
No, I don't think we'll see a physical Google card. And I guess the bigger problem is the fact that what Google's done so far in the payment systems has really just been kind of crappy. You know, every time I'm back in the Bay Area, you know, I see the Google payment, you know, key, you know, little logo there. And I ask the retailers, I say, you know, do people actually use this? Does it work? And 100% have all said it doesn't work. I've tried it myself. And on my Google Wallet account and I did it last year, it didn't work. And so I worry that Google is using their kind of beta kind of philosophy to kind of roll this product out. Money is a different game with people. When you mess with their accounts and mess with their money and it doesn't work, it adds a lot of insecurity. So I think Google's got to be a little more careful with this product launch than a lot of the others that they do.
Well, and it looks like that's what's happening, right? I think the most interesting part of this story is that Larry Page apparently killed the card after he was displeased with the demo. This is an example of Google changing. This is what Larry Page has been saying. We're going to focus. We're going to do things right. And we're going to get away from the Google that had Gmail in beta for 5 years. And we're not going to put glitchy stuff out. That's what I read from this, is that he's like, this isn't ready. Then we're not putting it out at I.O. I don't think it necessarily means they'll never do it, although I'm still a little unsure why I want a card. I get the idea of like, oh, people are familiar with that, and it'll help tide them over. But yeah, I agree with what everybody's saying, where it is pretty glitchy the few times that I've seen it used. And kudos to Larry Page for saying, no, well, we're not coming out with this until it's ready, especially because of what Eric said. This involves money. All right. How about The Onion? They got hacked like everyone else did by the Syrian Electronic Army, but their response, quite different. They detailed the entire procedure that the Syrian Electronic Army went through to hack The Onion with screenshots and everything. Here's what happened. And this is I love that they did this because it lets you know this is how easy it is for things to fail and get hacked. They phished one account. They were able to get one account to click on a compromising link out of all the employees at The Onion, which are hundreds. I don't know exactly how many, but they were able to get just one person. That allowed them to access one internal email account. Then they were able to phish two more accounts by sending the same compromised link internally, but from an internal email address. So people were less likely to be skeptical. They're like, oh, that's coming from Bob. Okay. So then they were able to phish two more accounts, just two more accounts, and one of them had access to the social media accounts. The IT department discovered this, sent out a note saying, hey, everybody, change your password. The phishers copied that note and sent it out to everyone from one of the compromised accounts so that they tricked two more accounts into being phished. This gave them a total of five accounts inside the company. At that point, IT realized what was going on and forced a password reset and locked them out. But they had, the damage was already done. They'd already taken a charge of the Twitter account and put up some stuff. Onion IT not only detailed all of this for us, which nobody else who's been hacked has done, but also put some recommendations. They said, first of all, educate your users about this sort of thing and how easy it is to get tricked into clicking on a link and logging in accidentally. Isolate Twitter accounts from your normal organization's email so that even if your email does get compromised, they don't automatically get access to your social media. Use an app like Hootsuite to allow multiple people to manage a social media account. But even if one of those accounts does get compromised, it's easy to block them and get them kicked out, and have an alternate means of reaching your users besides email. Because one of the problems is when IT sent out the email, some of the hackers were able to mimic that. And so you need a different way of communicating people. It reminds me of when email would be down and IT would send out an email that email was down and no one would get it until email came back up. Eric, what do you think of this? The Onion kind of taking the opposite. Everybody else says, no, wait, you just don't talk about the hack. At worst, you admit it happened, but you don't say anything about it. Onion's saying, let's educate the public about what happened so we can stop it.
Two things. One, I hope the Onion IT guys are getting raises because they did really a great job on this. You know, I have personal experience dealing with the Syrian Electronic Army. When I was at France 24 last year, we were DDoSed by them, and they're pretty aggressive. Now, I think it's really important to kind of identify, you know, the fact that we don't know exactly who the Syrian Electronic Army is. Is it the government? Is it the intelligence service? Is it diaspora? We don't really quite know. One very interesting thing about this is that it reveals some of the new modern kind of techniques of warfare that we're seeing out of Syria, you know, so DDoSing and obviously going after Twitter accounts and really trying to get into the social media narrative has been a big part of what they're doing. You know, they launched about 10,000 fake YouTube videos to try and throw off news agencies, and it's been very effective. They've been torturing people for passwords. And so in many ways, this does show kind of the direction that warfare is going. Really down the roads, if you're a reader of Evgeny Morozov, this is the dark side of the net.
Ayaz, do you think it was the right move to open this up?
Yeah, I think so. The thing is, if you have this information out there, and some people are in the chat room freaking out, like, how could you trust the Onion? Because it's on their blog. It's not on, like, their Onion News website where they're pretending, like, oh, we got hacked and this is how it happened. It's an actual story by their IT department here. And having these screenshots and showing the things that happen in just a regular office workspace, it's just an office like everywhere else, just so happens they write some really funny stuff. It's this kind of information that if people are reading this, they go, oh, okay, if it happened to the Onion, this is what happened there. I don't want this to happen to me. So they do that.
The Onion's also, I mean, satire. They're not trying to pass stories off as if they're real. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that it's, you know, a wink, wink type of thing. I think the Onion is completely in the right here. I think it's, you know, it never fails to sort of boggle my mind that just takes one person to either not really understand what a phishing scheme looks like, or just to be in a hurry. You know, maybe you were sort of waiting for maybe a PR person to get through to you, and you're just not really looking at who the sender was or what the link is. This is not hard to do. And I think that companies should take extra measures. The Onion has some really good tips for all sorts of companies where a lot of people might get into the situation and spread the good word.
Wait, the Onion isn't a real news source?
Oh, Tom. Where do I start?
Take it out of my RSS feeds. While I do that, Ayaz, tell us about this whole Windows 8 iTunes mess.
Sure, let's do that. So Tammy Reller, the CFO of Microsoft's Windows division, told CNN Money that you shouldn't expect an iTunes app in Windows 8 anytime soon. iTunes is in high demand. The welcome mat has been laid out. It's not for lack of trying, which implies that Microsoft has been talking to Apple, trying to get iTunes for Windows 8 in their app store. Now, you can run iTunes on the desktop in Windows, so you can still always do that. But to have a Metro-style or modern UI version, that doesn't exist yet. iTunes works on the desktop, like I said. Apple also has made software for Windows that it's discontinued. It made Safari for a while. QuickTime's still there, last updated in November 2012. And then there was an article at CNET by David Carno who argues that Apple should start developing Android apps. It specifically mentioned iBooks, iTunes, and iCloud ports, because why not get people on Apple services? Eric, do you think that Apple should be opening up their software to more hardware?
I don't know. It's not what I think necessarily about what, you know, I think it'll be a cold day in hell before we see Apple kind of go out to those platforms. I mean, you really look at the culture of Apple and you look at the culture of Google. Google is really believing in open, and obviously Apple believes in closed ecosystems. So it's just, I don't think it's in their DNA to do this. And, you know, in terms of the Windows Metro, iTunes, it's just an ultimate, you know, clear evidence that Metro just has not caught on in the eyes of the audience and the consuming public, because I think if there was a big enough market there, they might consider it, but it's just not there.
Sir, iPod didn't take off until iTunes became available on Windows. I mean, it was a niche device. It only worked on Macs, only worked with certain software. Then iTunes came up for Windows, and iPod became just gigantic. Mm-hmm. Should Apple be thinking about this? Because Android's eating up market share from the iPhone all the time. Should they be having the same approach that Google has for its apps?
I don't see it happening. I think that David Carnoy makes a good point that, wow, Apple could really open up their business if they were to accept the Android ecosystem and try to figure out how it would work with Apple's own existing. But I don't see that happening tomorrow or next year or ever.
Then what do you make of this? We got Microsoft going into hardware. Should Apple become more of a software player?
Yeah, they should. Derek's right. They won't. I think kudos to David Carnoy for coming up with a good click receiving yet defensible opinion piece there. I used to work with David, and he's a good writer. And this is a good way to get a good conversation started, right? You know, yeah, Apple should go on Android. What? You're crazy. They'll never do that. I totally think they should, and I totally don't think they will. I would just be echoing what Eric said. It is against Apple's way of doing things to open up easily to things. That said, if Windows 8 Metro took off and became a big enough market share, they might be forced into considering it. But that same logic could apply to Android, and I don't think they'll ever do that. It's just too much of a direct competitor.
I wonder if there's still some tension between Microsoft and Apple when it comes to bringing Office to iPad and the cut that Microsoft did not want to pay Apple, because Apple wanted to take 30% of all these subscription fees. Now, maybe they're just playing back and forth bargaining chips. Like, if you want iTunes in a Metro interface, maybe you'll give us 30% when you get Office subscriptions back and forth. I could see this being constant conversations that the two companies are having, but trying to get software.
The thing is, you know, we heard Bill Gates saying earlier this week that iPad users were very frustrated that they don't have Microsoft Office on the iPad. And the thing is like, yes, I'm sure you're out there, but most people just don't care. And I think that Apple realizes that their consumers are not like, if only more Windows programs would run on our iDevices, we would just be happier. People are figuring out how to live without these companies getting along very well.
I think Apple would be enjoying that revenue stream, though. If they were getting 30% for doing nothing, I think they would quite enjoy it. They've been doing that for lots of other products.
But Apple's sort of a company that believes on principles, flawed as they may be sometimes.
They remind me a lot of the State Department's Defense Trade Controls Office in some ways. Let's finish off with Nick Bilton's New York Times story exposing the underbelly of human behavior, humans endangering you in flight, Sarah.
That's correct, Tom. A new study released yesterday by two industry groups, the Airline Passenger Experience Association. Did you know that existed? Well, it does. And the Consumer Electronics Association says as many as 30% of all passengers polled said that they had accidentally left a device on during takeoff or landing. 67% said, we ain't never do this. 4% said, I don't know, maybe. I just don't know if I've done that or not. Another segment of the study polled passengers if they turn their devices off or are they just going to airplane mode. 59% of passengers say yes, all the way off, because that's what we're told to do. 21% say airplane mode is fine. That disables the main radios of a gadget. 5% say sometimes. And then, the rest of them said, well, I don't even know. I don't even know if I have electronic devices that apply to this study. But this is, you know, this is sort of the ongoing argument that some people have that say, listen, if it's not interfering in flight, then this is just a stupid rule and it needs to be changed. Nick Bilton, who wrote this article, the update, has been talking about this for the last couple of years. Says, you know, this is confusing because the FAA permits passengers to use something like an electric razor or an audio recorder during all phases of flight. You never have to turn that off, even though they give off more electronic emissions than, say, a tablet. So, you know, an iPad or, you know, something.
Wait,
something
I can
like
use
that.
My electric razor during takeoff and landing?
Correct, Tom. There just isn't any restriction against that because they haven't found it to interfere with the, you know, the onboard computer and what the pilots have to do. But do they really find that with any other device? Well, no. And you've got Senator Claire McCaskill, she's a Democrat from Missouri, who's really, really pushing to change these FAA's rule because, again, she doesn't feel that, it needs to be there. Eric, where do you stand on this highly, highly controversial issue?
Well, listen, I mean, there's not a single piece of evidence, and Bilton has talked about this over the years, that supports the airline industry's contention that it does interfere. What the real reason probably people think that the airline industry wants it is that during takeoff and landing, they actually want you to try and pay attention. That's presumably the argument. But Bilton comes up and says, well, there's nothing stopping you from reading a print magazine or a print book either. So, you know, there's really nothing here. I suspect that this was a law that was made back when Motorola had those big brick phones and they were all freaking out over, you know, is this going to cause cancer? Is it going to interfere with the communications? And it just hasn't been updated. And in Washington, if nothing else, there's inertia. And changing laws is really, really hard, as we can see. But I think this is a joke.
Does it worry you that so many people say, you know what, airplane mode is just fine. You think you want it turned all the way off, but you don't really know what you're talking about, FAA.
It used to bug me when I'm sitting on a plane and I see somebody still listening to headphones when we're ready to take off. I'm like, wait, that guy is going to cause a problem someday. But it doesn't ever happen so far. I think Eric's right. The government's moving at a glacial pace when it comes to changing things like this because things work fine the way they do. Mm-hmm. Let's not mess with it. You only need one case where something goes wrong where people will freak out because this is not like a car crash. This is a plane. This is a lot of people. And in theory...
Well, car crashes can be really awful too.
What I mean is the amount of people in one vehicle is just much larger than an airplane than when it comes to these massive flights. We're all sharing this together. And so I think there's a potential for less freakouts if FAA still keeps to their ideas of turn everything off. Yeah, we'll turn a blind eye. We know you're not plugged into our in-flight entertainment system. You're not rocking out to the announcement to buckle your seatbelt. We know you're really on your iPod. But I just think that they don't want to change it just for the sake of no change. They just want to keep everything the same because people are doing whatever they want and nothing's happening.
Tom,
I'm going to stick up for the FAA.
All right, let's hear it.
It's bureaucratic inertia at worst. And the reason it's good to have bureaucratic inertia in the FAA is because they want to make sure when they change a regulation that they aren't changing one that endangers your life. Now, you can definitely criticize them for being over careful, but frankly, I'd rather they be a little over careful than the opposite. That'd be under careful. So I think this was probably, as Eric said, put in place when they really didn't know what the effects were going to be. And there was a lot more radiation leakage. And I don't mean radiation like nuclear radiation. I just mean like wireless transmission were broader and they were bigger out of these devices. Now that they're all locked up, the FAA really needs to be doing very strict testing to be comfortable that these aren't going to affect the plane and then approve them. And I know that the FAA has said that they are reviewing this, so hopefully that won't take too much longer.
Yeah, I mean, Senator McCaskill says, I will introduce legislation if the FAA doesn't listen to me. She's very strong in her convictions that we shouldn't have to be turning off our electronic devices, or at least not all the electronic devices that we currently have to turn off.
Let's move on to the randomizer. A 14-year-old has discovered that the magnets built into the iPod that allow the cover to click on can shut off your implanted defibrillator if you fall asleep with the iPad on your chest. Gianna Shen made the discovery as part of a science fair project that somehow didn't win the science fair, according to MacRumors.com.
The volcano was really good, Tom.
But she will be presenting her findings to 8,000 doctors at a meeting of the Heart Rhythm Society in Denver. Good enough for the Heart Rhythm Society of Denver. Not good enough for the science fair, apparently.
Well, this isn't terrifying at all.
Actually, it's not. It's more like knowledge. If you know, you can be safer. If you have an
implant.
Right,
smart covers aren't the only things with magnets in them.
Well, it's not the smart covers, it's the magnets issue in the iPad, but you're right, yeah.
You don't fall asleep with a refrigerator on you and the magnet falls in. You're talking about an iPad, you're reading, and then boom, you got a problem.
Don't fall asleep playing with those little magnet balls.
The buckyballs.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of something else in my life that I, you know, holding regularly that also has magnets in it.
Those silly bracelets that are supposed to be like all good for your chi or something.
Well, I don't wear those.
Well, I'm just trying to think, what else do people use with magnets?
That's a snake oil gadget. I don't know. Yeah, I guess there aren't that many magnet things that I fall asleep with.
I don't know. I mean, if you fall asleep, you know, laying against your foot.
I also don't have a defibrillator, so.
You don't?
Not an issue yet.
Okay, good point.
Could be one day.
Don't fall asleep during takeoff and landing with the iPad on your chest.
Not without it being in airplane mode, that's for sure.
The magnet needs to go into heart defibrillator mode. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
That message is just moseying on. Don't worry about it. I got a message from Matt. He says, hey, guys, love the show and the Twit Network in general. I had a thought earlier today about the hoopla surrounding the glass pricing. I feel it might be a case of temporary pricing, pricing it out of the range of consumers, but giving those hardcore developers a fair chance to jump at it. Google has already stated this initial Explorer model is intended for developers to develop applications for it, and given the very few available out of the gate, it makes sense to keep it out of the hands of the everyday Joe as much as possible to mitigate the short-sighted, no applications, doesn't do anything, it's going to fail commentary. I have a feeling that this $1,500 price tag is not the true price and will come down to a more reasonable few hundred bucks max once Google is comfortable with releasing it to the general public. I always see similar tactics with some app developers where rather than remove the app from an app store, they raise the price to some outlandish cost to bar new customer access while keeping it available for existing customers. Thanks and keep up the great work.
I'd never heard of that last part. That's interesting. Have you guys heard of that before?
Didn't Tweetbot, one of the Twitter
raising clients, the price like that?
I think a Twitter client did that with, in response to the limitations to the Twitter API.
Interesting. Well, good stuff, Matt. Thank you for writing in. And thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. Eric Olander, always great to have you on the show. And are you in Vietnam right now?
I'm in Vietnam right now. So
your connection held up. It was awesome.
It was fantastic this time.
Yeah, looked really good. Let folks know where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find your work, what you're up to these days.
Yeah, well, it's not really directly related to technology, but if you're interested in international relations, we do a weekly podcast on China-Africa relations. We got a Facebook page at facebook.com/China-Africa Project. Got about 65,000 people now following that, and you can find me on Twitter as well.
You can also find our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. That's the place where you can let folks know what stories you would like us to cover on the show. And I say let folks know because it lets us know, but also lets the other people in the audience know. They can go and they can vote. You can do that too. Vote them up, vote them down. We look at that every day when we put together our lineup. Also, don't forget, if you liked a particular part of any show, twit.tv/best of. Any show on the Twit Network, let us know. Hey, I thought that part was pretty funny. This is the episode it was in. Maybe the time code. That's especially helpful. And we will put that in our best of episode at the end of the year. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT. At twit.tv, and you can give us a call, leave us voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back on Monday with Sharif Sark. See you then.